Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. Today on the show, I'm so excited to have 20-year coding veteran and founder of DevMastery.com, Bill Sarur. Bill, you want to say hi?
Hello.
Did I do your name right?
You did, absolutely. Yeah, it was a wonderful job.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So you have done a lot of things. You are a developer. You've been coding for many years. You were an architect. You're a consultant. You have this website where you teach other people little tips and tricks and things about coding to make them better programmers. Today, we're going to talk about something that happened very early on in your career when you were 21 years old and you got your first full-time job at an interactive marketing firm.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened then?
Yeah, so I was living in Toronto, Canada at the time. And up until that point, I had been doing, I did a little bit of freelancing to get myself through university. And before that, I was working for my dad's consulting firm, writing some code for him on weekends and in the summer and stuff, for his clients. And so at this point, my first sort of, I guess, desk job or real job was at this web agency that had been founded by a medical doctor. So as a result of it being founded by a medical doctor, a lot of our clients were pharmaceutical companies. And in Canada, there's some pretty strict laws around how you can, as a pharmaceutical company, advertise prescription drugs directly to consumers. And what it boils down to is you can't really explicitly advertise a particular drug along with saying what that drug treats. So at the time, there was this trend where these pharmaceutical companies would create informational websites, that would basically give general information about whatever symptoms their drug treats without explicitly mentioning the name of their drug. And we would, we would build a lot of these kinds of sites. So it came to pass that I was working on a particular site for a drug that was aimed at women. And because of the way the site was sort of designed, it was very clear it was aimed primarily at young women. And one of the features of this site was a quiz that helped women determine what type of medication may be right for them for a certain category of symptoms. So I had in the business requirements, I had all the questions for the quiz and I had all the multiple choice answers, but I didn't have any requirements around what to do with the answers. So I'm supposed to presumably recommend some kind of treatment at the end of this quiz. And there was no guidance or rules on how to do that. So I'm not a doctor. I have no idea. So I asked, can I get the business rules around this? And I got them and I coded the quiz. And went through QA and everything seemed fine. And right before it was about to be shown to the client, project manager decided to try it out. She came over to my desk and she said, listen, this quiz that you coded doesn't work. And I go, what do you mean it doesn't work? I'm pretty sure it works. How is it not working? What did I do wrong? And so she says, well, almost anything I answer, it ends up ostensibly recommending this pharmaceutical company's the type of drug that this pharmaceutical company is selling. She said, the only exception is if I say I'm allergic to that type of drug, then it recommends something else. Or if I say I'm already taking it, then it invites me onto the patient portal. So I said, have you looked at the requirements? Because that's exactly what the requirements say to do. It's coded up to spec. So she said, oh, okay. And she kind of left. And, at the time that I did that, it really, nothing struck me as strange about that. Because, in my mind, I knew that the real purpose of this site was to, to sell this particular drug. So the fact that, of course, the quiz is always going to recommend that particular drug. But the reality is the visitors to that site don't necessarily have the same information. I mean, you can, if you're pretty savvy about it, you can sort of figure it out. You'll see the company's logo. And if you dig enough, you can figure it out. But generally speaking, the site is really laid out as an informational site. So We coded it. We put it into production. The client was very, very happy with the site. Their account manager invited the entire team that had worked on it, including myself, out to a fancy steak dinner in Toronto. And the day of that dinner, I was sent a link to an online article that had described a young lady who unfortunately had committed suicide. And that young lady had been taking this particular drug that I had built the site for. And the article suggested that because one of the drug side effects was severe depression and suicidal thoughts, that her family anyway attributed that that suicide, at least in part, to this drug. And at that time, you know, that news hit me pretty hard, and it made me realize that you know, sometimes even something that might seem an innocent or tactic, or something that you might chalk up as just marketing or just an innocent or slight deception, can have pretty serious consequences. And looking back on it, I wish I had refused to code that quiz. And I want to make clear, because I think sometimes this gets lost, that it's not, you know, what I consider it an unethical act on my part, and that's what I'm ashamed of. But it's not the outcome that makes it unethical. It's the deception. What I mean by that is, you know, this was treating a category of symptoms that someone, especially a young person, may not be super comfortable talking to friends or family about, and so they would probably go online and they'd probably be looking for information, and they're being presented this quiz as if it's, you know, objective, unbiased, you know, medical sounding advice. And really the motive behind it is to get her to ask her doctor for this particular medication. So that's what makes it unethical. The tragic outcome, or at least the tragic news, is what made me realize that doing these kinds of things can have pretty grave consequences. Needless to say, I didn't stay at that job much longer after that. I got out of there and found something else.
So when you first read that article that mentioned the young woman who committed suicide, what was your initial reaction?
Rationalization, actually. So I guess, well, the first reaction was sadness, but very quickly after that, I tried to sort of rationalize it and say, well, there, I mean, you don't know that it's the drug that did that. And I mean, there could have been other things at play. And definitely my mind went to, well, I mean, the site was just launched, so she was probably on it before the site existed, so it's not my fault. You know, a lot of that went on as well. The first reaction was sadness, but the second reaction was definitely this sort of trying to rationalize my part of it. And then it so happened that my own sister, who at the time was still a teenager, she was, I think, she just turned 19 or something, happened to be taking that drug.
Oh, wow.
We'd had a conversation about it when I first got assigned the website. You know, we were just talking and, you know, what are you working on kind of thing. And she said, oh, I'm taking that. And I thought it was kind of a neat coincidence. You know, after I read that article, you know, my mind kind of went to her. And so we had a conversation and she spoke to her doctor and found an alternative. You know, I asked her basically about her mood and if she'd noticed the change. And then I recommended that maybe she should talk to her doctor and see if there's a different solution that she could deal with. Yeah.
So at some point after the rationalization, it did sink in, right? The guilt sinked in, the fact that you played a role in this hit you hard. When did you accept that responsibility?
So it nagged at me for a couple of days. I think what happened is I had guilt almost immediately, and so the rationalization was actually a defense mechanism against the guilt, right? And then eventually, after a few days, I said, well, you know, ultimately, I could have said no, I should have said no, and I need to stop being in a position where I have to make that kind of a choice. So maybe there's something else for me to do. So I quickly found another you know, luckily I quickly found another job and exited that agency.
So in that moment, when you read that article and kind of were going back and forth just with yourself and figuring out, you know, how you felt about it, did you end up telling coworkers or friends about that internal battle?
I did. I had some conversations with coworkers. The consensus of the people who worked there, and ultimately they ended up staying there, was that, you know, it's not, we can't hold ourselves accountable for that kind of thing. I mean, they were in the rationalization mode that I was in, and you know, they bought into it. And I mean, there's definitely like, look, if you know, there's a million ways to rationalize it, and there is obviously some distance between, you know, my actions and the consequences. But, you know, the conversations ranged a little deeper, like, well, isn't this whole business that we're in, where these companies are essentially making these sites that look like information sites, but they're advertisements? I mean, doesn't that, you know, bother you? And, you know, the feedback was, and I mean, I would imagine it's the same thing that the companies themselves would tell you. So the company logo is somewhere on the site. It's there on the site. It's not particularly hidden. There's disclaimers, you know, in small writing that you can easily find, sort of, that say, you know, this is for information purposes only, you know, talk to your doctor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And certainly, and this is indisputable, you know, nothing that we were doing was in any way illegal. So it was kind of like, you know, what's your, we don't see the big problem. Like, yeah, it's too bad that this one thing happened to this one person. We don't see that we're in any way to blame for that, or nor should you blame yourself. And certainly the work that we're doing, is there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly legal, and there's ample opportunity for, you know, consumer or buyer beware kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the, you know, if it were that bad, it would be illegal perspective is a popular one. And it's interesting because, you know, taking it slightly away from just coding and building products, when we think about just the role that the rules and the law plays in how we make decisions, is it the job of people who create those laws to decide for us what is right and what is wrong? And if they haven't declared it and made it illegal, then anything is fair game, right? That would be the way that we operate in the world. And that doesn't sound quite right to me. Have you thought much about kind of the role of it being legal or illegal, and how that should dictate what you do and how you decide to use your skills?
So generally speaking, I think laws lag ethics, in the sense that I think ethics and morality evolves, you know, within a particular culture over time. And I think that the laws are usually playing catch up to that. I mean, you could take many, many, many examples. You know, gay marriage, for example, I think culturally we accepted that way before legally that was accepted. You know, so the law is playing catch up. And similarly with you know, restrictive laws or whatever, I mean, it takes, usually there's some tragedy or some bad thing happens, or a number of bad things happen, and there's a critical mass, and there's enough, you know, enough stories out there saying, hey, this is really bad and that really shouldn't happen, there ought to be a law, and then the law gets made. So you relying on the law to be there ahead of you, I don't think is necessarily the right approach. I think that you have to accept that your own moral compass and your own ethics and society's ethics writ large are going to be ahead, maybe half a step ahead of the laws. The other thing too, I mean, if we zoom out a little bit and just talk about sort of the responsibility that we have as developers, in terms of the idea that software is everywhere. So you almost can't go through a single day without interacting, if not directly, even indirectly, with a whole pile of software. So there's software, you know, in your car, between, you know, when you hit the brake pedal and when your car stops, there's software interceding there. There's software at the cash register. There's software everywhere. And so if we you know, if we're not thinking about the consequences of our actions and finding ways to regulate ourselves as a profession, then the laws will catch up and then they will start. There's a talk by a famous author and a computer programmer named, he's sometimes called Uncle Bob, but it's Bob Martin. It's called The Future of Programming. And in there, he makes this point, and he talks about, as an example, the Volkswagen scandal that was happened not too long ago, where basically their cars were faking the output for an emissions test so that they would pass. Wow. They would pass this emissions test, and it was a pretty big scandal, and the CEO of Volkswagen was called in front of a Senate committee or something, and essentially he said, you know, well, I don't know, these programmers decided to, you know, to put that code in there. And the point that Bob Martin makes is, I mean, it's a silly thing to say for some reason, but ultimately there was programmers. I mean, there were programmers there who did that, who wrote code that cheated, and, you know, they probably knew they were doing that, you know, if in test mode, then, right? So, you know, it's not going to take too many of those kind of incidents before the government sort of decides that they do need to intercede, and they do need to place laws around our profession and around what we do. And I you know, you can debate how much or how little a government should be involved in these kind of things, or the law should be involved in these kind of things. But certainly, you know, for us as a profession, I think we'd want to be ahead of that. And we'd want to form our own kind of guidelines and our own kind of code of ethics before it gets foisted upon us by, you know, people who are not necessarily members of our profession, but who are legislators, right?
Yeah. And I think part of the complication of this is that there's so many different parties involved. If we think about the example, the story that you brought up, there's the coders, there's the PM that manages the project, there's the pharmaceutical company that's creating the product. And then even within the pharmaceutical company, there are the researchers that are actually making the drug. And then there's the account managers that have to sell it. And there are the marketing people who have to market. There's so many different people and teams involved in very discrete, siloed roles in making sure that patients buy and use and hopefully are helped by this drug. In that type of environment where the pieces are completely spread out, how do you balance being responsible for your small piece with feeling responsible for the outcome? Because there's a big distance, right? There's a big distance between you creating that app and a young woman who died because she took it. There's like 10 different steps. There's 10 different layers in between you and her. So how do you appreciate that responsibility without feeling too responsible in something that maybe you only had a small part in?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things there. I mean, I think, you know, if you generalize it, the question, and it's a question that's been struggled with for forever, is, you know, how far removed you have to be from a given act before you're blameless, right? And so historically, there's a whole bunch of examples of looking at that question in very serious ways. So the example that's most within reach for people is the Nuremberg trials and the whole, you know, after the generals and the officials of government and so on, the next part of the Nuremberg trials, they went after, you know, civil servants and people who were one or two steps removed. And so there's definitely precedent of saying, you know, even if you're somewhat removed from a situation, you're still accountable to some degree. You know, having said that, I think the guiding axiom, if you will, or the thing that I've sort of kept in my mind when writing code is don't write code that violates a user's trust. And I think I've read some of your work, and I think you talk about that as well. The idea of the sanctity of a user's trust. I mean, like I said before, you can't go through a day, you can't almost live a modern life without interacting with so much software. And so you're putting, there's an implicit trust that you're putting in all of that software to work in a certain way, to be somewhat transparent. And so you know, as a programmer, if you're ever asked to do something and you consider, well, is this thing that I'm asked to code or to do, is this a violation of the user's trust? And I think if it is, then, you know, you're going to have to make a difficult choice as to whether that's okay for you or not. For me personally, and I don't want, you know, I wouldn't presume to be, you know, to judge others, but for me personally, you know, it's not okay. So if I'm asked to code something that in my mind is a violation of the user's trust, I wouldn't do it. And I think that's at least one way, and maybe it's an oversimplification, but it's one way that we could have a guidepost. But it's very difficult. Like, as you said, there is a lot of complexity there. There are many parties involved. There's also the fact that, you know, one of the things that makes it important, I think, for us as a profession to come together and figure this out is the ubiquity of software and the fact that code is everywhere. So one of the things that makes it really important is also one of the things that makes it very, very difficult. So I'll give you an example. So you would think that logically, okay, what if we just said, never write any code that harms anyone? Well, okay, but what if you're in the military and you're writing a weapons guidance system? Is that unethical? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe that's a valid use case, but it's hard to argue that no one's going to get hurt from that. And then there's a whole other aspect too that I don't know that there's much we can really do about it, but there's certainly code that may be written for an innocent purpose or an innocent intent and then gets used maliciously. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you watched the Snowden movie.
I haven't yet.
Well, if you it's a fictional, the one I'm talking about is the Oliver Stone one, which is fictional. So, you know, I don't know what's true or what's not because it is fiction. But if you believe the contents of that movie, essentially he wrote software that was meant to do hyper efficient backups. Essentially, it was backing up information quickly in real time, and then that was the software that ended up being used to spy on American citizens. So, you know, he wouldn't certainly have had an issue at the time, you know, being asked to write it or writing it, thinking, oh, well, this is unethical because it's just a backup system. But then, lo and behold, a backup system gets used for a pretty nefarious purpose. So there's that aspect as well that I don't think we'll ever be able to do anything about it. But I think as a start, at least if we had some way to coalesce around a code of ethics. And unfortunately, I think it's going to take a tragic event. I know for doctors, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but I know that for doctors, there was something like a 40-year study on men with syphilis, like a clinical trial where a number of men were given essentially placebo and tracked, right? And of course, that's a very, untreated can lead to very grave consequences for people. And so at some point in the 70s, at the conclusion of that that particular trial, when it was seen that, you know, really people's health was put in very, very grave risk, is when I think the medical profession, at least in the U.S., really coalesced around a certain code of ethics and started to understand, you know, where the line is and what they will do and what they won't do. And I mean, hopefully it doesn't take an event like that in terms of our profession to get us moving. But I don't know.
Yeah, and to your point about the Snowden movie and the example of it was supposed to be just really efficient backups and it ended up being used for something else, I think that to me is the thing that makes me very anxious about technology. I can't remember who first said it, but I remember hearing someone say in a talk that platforms are amoral. And that was the first time I really thought about the ethics of coding and the ethics of the products we build. And it really just terrified me that I could build something that I thought was going to be really great and awesome and used for powerful, beautiful things, and to have someone come in and do something absolutely terrible with that thing that I made.
Right. I mean, the simple example there is the knife, right?
That's a good one. Yeah,
right? In the hands of a chef, fantastic. Yep. In the hands of a murderer, it's a bit of a problem.
And so that makes me wonder, how do you think about the role of the developer. You wrote in a blog post, as developers, we are often one of the last lines of defense against potentially dangerous and unethical practices. I think that's absolutely true. But does that mean that as we code, we should be asking those questions proactively, right? In your example, when you were doing the pharmaceutical website, you were kind of told, you know, this is what it's for, this is what it's doing. But in cases where maybe we aren't given those details and we're kind of just in our own little bubble of make this faster, make this, you know, button work, do you think it's our responsibility to understand that domain and make an ethical call?
I think so. I think, not just from the perspective of ethics. There's a great, you know, another great talk by a gentleman named Martin Fowler, who's another very well-known author, programmer author, called Not Just Code Monkeys, something like that. And, you know, he makes the point that as a developer, your role isn't just to simply blindly, you know, follow orders and implement requirements, but you should strive to have some understanding of the domain that you're in, and then you should strive to actually become a genuine partner with the client or the business, you know, and work together on what the solution is. Because yes, it would be a defense from an ethical perspective, for sure. If you understood the implication of what you were doing, then you could make better decisions. But even going beyond that, just in terms of adding value as a member of an organization, if you understood the domain and the subject matter against which you were coding, you have particular knowledge, technical knowledge about what a computer can do, and you can make suggestions that would actually benefit the business. So if it becomes a collaboration and a two-way street, you can provide a lot more value that way. And I think, unfortunately, at least in my own experience, you know, I see a lot of times where there is this sort of code monkey mentality. It's not the greatest term, but there is this mentality of, you know, caffeine in, code out, you know, bring these folks in, you know, have them slave away at a keyboard, and they're just there to implement requirements. And I think that there's, you know, I don't necessarily put the blame entirely on the organizations that are hiring developers or you know, business clients. I think that there's some responsibility on the developer side too, where, you know, some of us are just focused on or excited by the code and don't care that much about the business. There's a great book by Michael Lewis called Flash Boys about high frequency trading. And one of the things in there is essentially this stock market has shifted and has become really just run inside of computers. There's a huge advantage to having basically the fastest algorithms. The faster your algorithm is, the faster your code runs, the more you can sort of take advantage of the market. And so there are all these computer programmers who are brought in, really talented, really smart computer programmers who are creating all these algorithms and systems that were essentially being used to make profits in what some people might consider a very unfair way. And the programmers didn't really know even or understand what it was that they were doing or what the value of it was. You know, they were just interested in the code and they didn't bother with the subject matter or the domain. So I think there's a role to play there. I think that, yes, from an ethical perspective, you should have an understanding of how the software you're writing is intended to be used, and you should be okay with that intended use. But also from a business perspective, in terms of being a professional and adding value to an organization, it's worthwhile understanding the domain that you're in and being more of a partner rather than just sort of a, you know, somebody cranking out some code.
If you had encountered the same pharmaceutical situation now, you probably would not have built that website. Is that a fair
conclusion? That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think any time, and luckily I haven't been in that situation, or I've avoided putting myself in that situation since. But I think anytime something is asked of me and I feel that that request is something that ultimately is violating a user's trust, I would say no. And, you know, I do recognize in some ways that, you know, I have the luxury of doing that. You know, I'm not worried about where my next paycheck is going to come from, you know. My family's okay. I'm okay. I have other options. And I certainly know that other people may not be so fortunate. So I don't want to cast aspersions or, you know, sit here and in judgment. I'm just, for myself, it's not something I would do again.
And I think a lot of this conversation has been about what should we do and how do we handle that responsibility and that request of building something that we're not necessarily, that we don't necessarily feel like is ethical and is the right thing to do. How much of it is our job to correct what will inevitably happen, whether or not we participate? So in that example, you were 21. It was, I believe, your first full-time paid, fully paid developer position. And so if you had said, well, I'm not going to do this, I don't agree with it, I assume they would tap one of your coworkers and say, okay, you do it instead, right? So even if you got away from that and you were no longer responsible for it, the job still would have been done.
Absolutely.
So how do you, yeah, how do you think about that?
But there's two things there. So one is just on the, I think individually, I think each person ultimately is, you know, responsible for their own actions, and you have to look at yourself in the mirror, and you have to be able to sleep at night, and you have to feel okay with the contributions that you've made in the world. So from the perspective of, I don't think on a personal perspective, the rationalization of, well, someone else is going to do it, so I might as well do it, I don't, for me anyway, that doesn't necessarily fly. But to the larger point of, well, regardless of how, you know, whether you what you personally feel about it, the ultimate end result is that something is going to happen and code is going to be out there that's going to violate a user's trust, and you refusing to do it does not change that outcome. I think that's where, if we're more united as a profession, and again, this is it's so much easier to say than to do. I've really been tossing this around for a little while now with a few folks, and it is a monumental challenge. So I don't mean to be glib about it or to say that it's a simple solution. But I think if there was, if we were united behind the idea that as a profession, we do not write code that violates a user's trust, and then we created similar to what doctors have and lawyers have and accountants have, you know, strong associations that basically, if you can't write that kind of code, and you can't, somebody, employers that are going to ask for that kind of thing are not going to be able to hire professional developers, and, you know, developers who are being asked that kind of thing have an association, a community, a code, some standards to fall back on, so it's not entirely on your shoulders, and you can't be, you know, you can't be dismissed, or they can't just go to the next coder because of the strength of that. I think that's potentially a solution. Again, way, way easier to say than to do, but we've got to find maybe a road to that somehow.
Why do you think we don't have a larger culture of ethical coding? You know, because I think we haven't been around that long, but I feel like we've been around long enough to have opinions on this. But as far as I've seen, I haven't seen a big kind of rise of, these are the things that we are okay with, these are things that are questionable. You know, I don't think we've really had a larger community-wide agreement on the ethics of things we build. Why do you think that is?
So I think there's a couple of things there. So one is, you know, if you go back to the traditional computer engineering, computer science, a lot of the universities, if you take computer science or computer engineering, do actually have courses on ethics that are part of the program. Not all of them, I think, are mandatory, but definitely as electives, and definitely as part of the curriculum, there is this discussion of ethics. So I don't think it's been completely absent. I also think, even going back to like the 90s, there is a code of ethics that was created by the Association for Computing, ACM. I forget what it exactly stands for, but there and that's not the only one. The IEEE also has a code of ethics. So there have been efforts in that direction, and there's been thinking about that kind of thing. I think where the reason that it hasn't caught on is twofold. So one is just the absolute ubiquity of software and code, and the fact that it's exploded so much, and it's so far reaching, and it's so everywhere, as you're talking about a very, very large and very diverse community. Like, it's a very heterogeneous community, so it's very hard to come together on almost anything when you're talking about that much, you know, that big of a community, and that much difference between different areas and members of the community. The other thing is, I think the rise in demand in terms of the marketplace has so outpaced the supply of people who are able to code that the focus, you know, market drivers make the focus on simply learning how to, you know, learning syntax and data structures and algorithms. And so there's all these coding schools and resources that have popped up, and their primary focus is to very quickly get people ramped up on the ability to write code. And I think a lot of other things get forsaken. So things like ethics might sound cynical, but I think it's somewhat accurate. Would these things become like luxury items, right? Like, we don't have time to also teach you ethics and to also teach you how to be professional and to also teach you what it means to be a developer beyond just, look, this is what a variable is, you know, this is what an object is, this is how to make things, you know, this is how to make a web request. These are the things you need to know so that you can be productive and start earning money and fill this huge gap that we have in the labor market. So I think that's added to it as well.
So what do you feel is the biggest takeaway for people who are listening who haven't quite, you know, been at those crossroads before with having to deal with an ethical dilemma when they code, but might get there in the future?
I think, you know, it's worthwhile asking yourself, it's worthwhile being aware of what the code you're writing is going to be used for, and it's worthwhile asking yourself if you personally are okay with that. I also think we are kind of lucky in terms of the times that we live in, where if you say no, things are not as dire as you think they are, in terms of there aren't 100 people behind you waiting to fill your job. It's not easy to fill jobs and to have.
You gotta take advantage of that.
Yeah.
while we have it.
Yeah. So you have more leverage. I think you have more leverage as a developer than maybe I think people realize and people know. So that would be a takeaway as well. And then I think the last thing that I would say on that question, and it's something that's sort of driving, I think, what I'm trying to do with Dev Mastery over time, is the idea that being a professional developer and coding for a living is about more than just code. And so if you're new to this, I understand, I know it's very overwhelming, and I know there is so much to learn, and I know it probably feels like you're never going to learn everything. And by the way, you won't. I'm over 20 years. I still don't know everything. There's a lot to learn. So I get that that's overwhelming, but also there needs to be a recognition that it's about more than just the actual code itself. You know, how you manage your time, how you conduct yourself as a professional in this industry, all of those things matter. And I don't think there is enough being done to teach those kind of things. And so that's what I'm hoping. I think with Dev Mastery, that's sort of where I'm hoping to go. It's very early. I started it sort of 9 months ago with this vague idea that I somehow wanted to take my experience and use it to give back to this community in some way. And I'm wasn't sure what that way was. And I still don't know if I've completely nailed down exactly what that is. But, you know, I've got this newsletter that I send out every week, and I talk to developers all the time. And what I'm figuring out, I think, is that we need to fill the gaps around, it's great to teach people JavaScript or what Java or whatever language or whatever framework, but I think we need to round out that education somehow and teach them about other skills that are as useful, if not, well, they're not more useful, but at least as useful as the actual being able to write the code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has that experience building that pharmaceutical website, how has that affected the way that you code today?
Yeah, so I think it just made me aware that I have to ask myself the question, you know, what is the end game here of what I'm producing? And is that something that ultimately I'm going to be proud of? Is that something that's contributing some value in a way that I think is positive? And if not, then maybe are there other options for me to go and use my skills and my time elsewhere?
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Saran. It was my pleasure.
So next, let's move on to some fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Sure.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is...
Okay, so this has nothing to do with code or technical. I had a really hard time coming up with something. I think we just forget, you know, if it wasn't useful advice, I think we're quick to forget it. Or maybe I'll be super optimistic and think that maybe I haven't gotten that much bad advice in my life. But I guess the thing that stands out is I have two young children. And at the time, I think one was three and one was just about 4.5. And they were having a really hard time eating their supper. They were almost leaving the table. And one of the things that they were fixated on was this idea of potentially having dessert or having a treat. We certainly don't have dessert every day, but they were sort of fixated on that, especially if they knew there was something, you know, that they would just, okay, I'm done. Now I want a treat. And I think my wife read somewhere that one tactic or one strategy for that was to let them have the treat at the table with their dinner, but they're not allowed to eat it until they're done their dinner. And somehow this is supposed to work and calm them down. And I had a feeling prior, like when I first heard this, I think I had a pretty strong reaction that I didn't think it was going to work, but keep an open mind. And yeah, that was just an epic train wreck. It did not work. It was essentially, I felt like I was torturing my children. I don't understand. I mean, maybe it works. It must have worked somewhere for someone for it to have been given out as advice, but that's by far the worst thing that I can think of that I got. It was not good. Yeah. So,
how do they react?
Well, they were fixated even more so on the cookie or whatever it was, you know, and then there was, you know, pleading puppy dog eyes. Can I have, can I just, it's right there. Can I just have it? You know,
it's right like, there.
Oh, no, just not, that was not good advice.
Yeah. Did you give in? Did you end up giving them the cookie?
No, but I asked my wife to take it off the time. Like, okay, we tried this.
Clearly it did not work.
And in fairness, maybe we misunderstood the advice or something. Or I'm like, whatever this is supposed to do, we're probably doing it wrong because this is not working.
Number two, my first coding project was about.
So I was 6 years old. And my father, who's in computers, this is the early 80s, just to place you. So my father came home with what's affectionately called a luggable computer, which is sort of the portable computer of the time. So think of like a really large, really heavy metal suitcase. And you take this thing and you put it on a desk and the top sort of pops off and it reveals this 10-inch monochrome, you know, green on black screen, and the top of the suitcase is actually a keyboard. And I was completely enthralled by this thing. Like, I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And this is a time when, you know, people did not really have, there weren't too many personal computers, or if you had a personal computer, it was just mainly used for word processing and, you know, but this thing just fascinated me. And so my dad, noticing my interest, decided that we would code something. And so we wrote a really basic, simple calculator program in BASIC at the time on that computer. And I remember that to this day. And I remember being really excited about it, and it sort of ignited this curiosity in me. And I think it's big reason of why I ended up doing what I do now is because of that experience.
Very nice. Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing I wish I knew when I first started to code was that you don't have to say yes to every crazy timeline that someone else decides to thrust upon you.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. This certainly had this period of my career where I wanted to be the hero. And so any crazy timeline, I would be the first to say, yeah, can you do this in 2 weeks? Yeah, I'll get it done in 2 weeks. And then, you know, I'd be literally sleeping under my desk, or, you know, just totally sleep deprived and binging on coffee and doing everything I could to just get this thing done and get it delivered on time. And I thought that that was the way that you make a name for yourself in this industry. I thought that that was the way that you get some career advancement. And I just thought that that was, you know, that was the right thing to do. And I wish I had known then what I know now, which is that's not at all the right approach. The right approach is to consistently say what you're going to do and do what you're going to say. So what happens if you go the way I went, which is you try to be the hero, there's never any break. You essentially, you've created and you've set an expectation that you're always going to be working 24/7 and always be delivering. And eventually it's an unsustainable thing. So eventually you crash, your health suffers, your relationships suffer, and then, you know, you become unreliable. So it's much more important to be consistently reliable than to be, you know, the yes person who's always saying yes and who's killing yourself to get things done under incredibly tight deadlines. That's not the way to go. So I wish I had known that when I started, for sure.
Yeah, really good advice. So next, let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Yeah, so I just want to point people to that talk by Bob Martin. It's called The Future of Programming. You can Google it, Bob Martin, The Future of Programming. It's pretty long. It's a long video. If you're impatient, you can skip to the last 9 minutes where he really gets into this kind of ethical discussion that sort of we've had. But the beginning of it is he traces the sort of history of programming all the way back to the time of Alan Turing until today. And it's absolutely a fascinating look at our profession and how it's evolved over time, and touches upon some really, really important issues about, you know, gender representation, for example, in our profession. And yeah, it's just awesome. It's a great talk. So it's on YouTube. It's called The Future of Programming by Bob Martin. And I recommend it to everybody. The second thing is, maybe you can put it in the show notes or something, it's something called an algorithm visualizer by a fellow named Jason Park. And it looks like it was just a hobby project, but this guy built this amazing little app that is all in JavaScript, and it's open source, and you've got this little tool that you can visualize a lot of common computer science algorithms. So you can actually see, you can run the algorithm and you can see sort of a visual representation of the algorithm working. You can also step through the code that's running behind the scenes and see the implementation. And it's, I mean, I'm a total geek, right? But I just find it like super interesting and cool. And so I would recommend that to almost anybody who's even thinking about computers. It's just a fun, interesting thing to explore. So those would be the two.
Very nice. And I've got a few personal shout outs. One is a blog post called Be Careful What You Code For. And it's written by Dana Boyd, who is an amazing researcher of technology and society. And she started this organization organization called Data and Society. And they look at how data impacts society and ask a lot of really big and important questions, a lot of them involving ethics. And so one of the blog posts that she wrote, called Be Careful What You Code For, goes into the responsibility of coders and how even though we're programmers, it doesn't mean that we can just, you know, be blind to the impact of our code and the impact of our work. And so she talks about a bunch of different things, including the environmental consequences, which I thought was fascinating. And frankly, I never really thought about too much before. You know, every time we do notifications and we send emails, what does that mean? How does that translate to the way we are affecting the physical environment, which I thought was really interesting. She talks about social consequences and what does the advertising ecosystem mean? How does being able to predict criminality in a neighborhood or by a specific person, where does that information come from? What biases does that lead to? And a bunch of other ideas and topics. I thought it was really, really good, really full of research and sources and facts. And so definitely something to look into. The second shout out I have is actually the one that you wrote, called The Code I'm Still Ashamed Of. And we talked a lot about this story and unpacked it a bit here. But if you want to look at the written version of this story, you can definitely check it out. It's published online. It's very, very beautifully written and beautifully done. And the last shout out I have is, I don't know if you've seen this, but it's this pledge called neveragain.tech.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Yeah.
And it felt very applicable to our conversation. And so here, as developers, as technologists, you have the opportunity to sign a pledge that basically says that we are going to protect those that need protecting, and we are going to do right with our code, and we are going to stand in solidarity with Muslim Americans and immigrants and people whose lives and livelihoods might be threatened with the future, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because it talks about, and I didn't know the history of this, but it talks about a couple moments in the past of big technology companies doing things that helped oppression and that helped things like the, you know, internment of Japanese Americans, that helped the Holocaust, that helped deportations, mass deportations. And so it's, if nothing else, it's very interesting to look at some of the articles listed and the resources listed to see how technology can play a role in something very, very horrible, even if we didn't intend for it to be that way. So I encourage you to check it out. And there's a nice long list of technologists who've signed their name, and you can make a pull request and sign your name there as well.
Yeah, it's really that one is really awesome. The only I'm just saddened that it's specific to the United States. I was ready to sign
right,
it.
Right. Yeah.
And it says
yeah.
In the United States, and there's a big discussion on that in the issue section of that GitHub about, you know, potentially broadening it. And then I think the worry is that if you've signed something, you know, and then the thing that you signed changes,
right? Yeah. It's
what's the impact late. Of that? So. But very interesting and a very good pledge. And if I was in the US, I would definitely have signed it. And also, like you said, the resources are good ones. And it's a good history lesson for us for sure.
If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code. Or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Bill, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Yeah, goodbye. Thank you so much, Saran. This was great.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.